Kyle, you want to do the intro?
Is this the one that we're have to do for Jeff? I thought we were going to
No. We'll add the pre-roll after.
Oh, okay.
Same as we have done for the last 60 episodes.
We'll do the pre-roll in post, if that makes any sense. Yes.
Yeah, totally.
You just say welcome back and introduce everybody. And okay. Off we go. We rolling, Chris?
Yeah, we're rolling.
All right, take it away, Mr. Trendside.
Really? It's like that? We don't even do music or nothing?
Just say, hey, welcome back. Do the thing. And we'll, yeah.
Hang on. You call me, dude, I just walked in from finishing a manwich, and you're like, oh, bro, go ahead and just start this thing. Here, you do it. You do it, Michael.
You want me to do it?
Yeah, dude. I just had cottage cheese, dude. I can't function on cottage cheese.
All right, you ready, Kyle? Here we go. I'll do the intro. Don't worry. Okay. All right.
I got a light incense, bro. I'm trying to get my crystals out. Like, got a smudge stick. It's Wolf Moon tomorrow, dude. We can't just jump right into this thing.
Wolf Moon? What is Wolf Moon?
You are listening to the Signal to Noise podcast on the ProSound Web Podcast Network. Signal to Noise is supported by Audix. Check out their new line of Pro Studio headphones and A131 and A133 large diaphragm studio condenser mics at audixusa.com. Alan and Heath has asked us to read the following statement. If a tree falls in the forest and no one is there to hear it, does it make a sound? Yes. Not only do I think it would make a sound, but it would be at least 20 dB louder than it was during soundcheck. Welcome back to the Signal to Noise podcast on ProSound Web. Kyle's really excited about the full moons. A couple episodes ago, he was really excited about the Friday the 13th occurring. He's got calendars. He has statistical operations and tables, and we're doing all kinds of stuff. As usual, I'm joined by my co-host, Kyle Turnside. What's up, buddy?
Hello. Hi. Hello.
I mean, to interrupt your preparations there with all your gear.
Oh, man. It's like a whole thing. I got to do my affirmations, my gratitude. Yeah. For a minute, I got this smudge stick that I didn't even light yet.
Oh, some sage. It's nice.
Yeah. Got to get it right, dude. Full moon's coming up.
And the man who's always on time, always prepared, and keeps me and Kyle in line, Mr. Chris Leonard.
Big What's time. Up? How's it going?
What's going on, buddy?
I'm on fire, man. There's a lot going on. I'm excited with what we've got going on, Signals to Noise. How we got loudest cranking. There's a lot going on.
Yeah, I've been really, it's been really cool to watch kind of, you know, you go through that process and see like, oh, here's my next cool guest that I'm looking forward to and the people that are reaching out to you. And it's contagious, man, to watch that energy and watch you invest yourself in this thing. And again, if anyone is listening, has not checked out Chris's project, How We Got Loud, definitely encourage you to check that out. He is, and you know what? I don't know who came up with the name for that show, but they must have been very creative and very handsome because that's a great name for the show.
Well, thank you, Michael, for the name.
let's say this too. You know what? Let's just get right into it because I can tell this is going to be a great conversation. This is our guest. This episode is kind of one of those names where, you know, I know when I started wanting to get serious about sound and, you know, when you start reading articles and looking at trade magazines and see what's going on, this is the name that just comes up over and over again. And so I can speak for all of us. We're really excited to have her on the show with us and really looking forward to this conversation. Ms. Carrie Kies.
Yay. Finally.
Finally. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, you know what? When I called Keith Clark like 2 years ago and said, hey, we should start a podcast, I think your name was one of the very first names that we threw out as people who wanted to come on the show. So we're glad we finally get to set it up. This is great.
Two years later, here we are, you know.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks for having me.
It was the wrong throw out. Like you threw out the name. You forgot to act. It was, never mind.
I get to ask more Black Flag questions at least this time again, too. So I'm into that.
I want to get into Fugazi.
Fugazi. There you go. All the time. All day Fugazi. And then we can have another episode, part two.
All right. Well, I mean, it's sort of like, you know, I always struggle when we have guests like you on, Carrie, because it's like you have such a crazy resume that you kind of, you know, it's very difficult to encapsulate. But I mean,
well, here you go. 27 years or maybe more than that at this point with Pearl Jam, right?
Yeah, I think we hit 30 last year. Yeah.
Oh, man. You did 10 years as monitor engineer for Chili Peppers.
Amazing. Yeah.
You know, other acts, we got Soundgarden, Sonic Youth, Fugazi, Neil Young, Corrosion of Conformity.
That's what I'm saying. It's I think Pearl Jam is the name that comes to my mind when I think of your work. And I mean, 27 years, you, and I told the guys on the text thread earlier, I want to ask you about this. You were with them for such that period of time that the advanced technology that we've seen, the advances in the way tours are run. I'm assuming the analog to digital transition happened when you were at the helm there. So, I mean, how was all that for you?
Yeah. It took us a long time to go digital. Because we always toured with production. I met those guys, and this is my advice to everybody. Be really super nice to your opening bands.
Oh, yeah.
Because they were the opening band for Chili Peppers on Blood Sugar Sex Magik tour.
I saw that tour. Oh, it was so good.
Yeah, great tour. Smashing Pumpkins were middle slot. So that's where I met them, and that's when I started working with them, and I stayed with them. I think most people know that the Pearl Jam pretty much blew up shortly after that tour.
Yes.
And so we always had production when we started on our own. So the band was very used to a certain sound that they came up with. And we toured a lot. So any changes that were ever made, there was a good chance someone in the band was going to notice and go, what changed? What happened? Why is this different? And sometimes we hit situations that we just couldn't swap out gear because someone was so married to that sound that you couldn't emulate. You know, you changed the board and it would change the whole sound of what was going on stage. So the transition to digital was kind of hard. Because one, we needed to find something that sounded warm and sounded analog. And at that, you know, that point in time, you know, digital consoles first came out, they didn't sound that great. They weren't that reliable. So, you know, we didn't switch over until, well, I'm trying to think of the year. I think maybe we switched in 2010, maybe. Wow. Yeah, we did a couple runs with, you know, PM5Ds, and it was just, there was all sorts of issues. And there was latency issues with ears for Eddie, so that, you know, he stayed analog for a long time. Even when we went, we went to a Midas, the Pro 9, but he still had a little in-ear analog setup for him. So yeah, it was a tough switch.
I have a fan.
Now we're on S5, and most of my life is nice.
I have a fanboy question. It goes along with the Pearl Jam thing. 10 was an amazing album. That album changed a lot of people's lives, mm-hmm. and a lot of way that we listen to music. Like, that was the beginning of the Seattle scene. It was insane. Like, the 90s yeah. were something super special. Yeah. How close did you, when you went to go do monitors for them and they played, how much did that translate in your monitor mix for them? Were you like, this sounds like the album when they play? Like, that's just what
I wish it did. I will say this, every time we do rehearsals in Seattle before a tour, the band, you know, we don't do we'll usually do production rehearsals with just the, you know, front of house monitors and backline. And then go into an arena to do pre-production after that. But so when we're in rehearsals, they're set up kind of in a circle. So Ed's facing all the guys. So we got Matt and Ed pretty much looking at each other, and then guitar and bass around him. That's the only time I can hear what Mike McCready is playing, because wow, he's stage right, I'm stage left. I can't hear his rig where I am. So we'll be doing rehearsals, and I'm like, wow, who's playing that tasty riff? Oh, it's Mike. Oh, that's part of the song. It doesn't sound like the album on stage.
Are they more like a punk rock band when they play? I mean, to you, coming from your roots, that Pearl Jam seems like they were like that crossover punk rock Seattle thing with the Melvins and Nirvana.
Yeah,
and
it's definitely, if you walk on our stage, it is a rock and roll band.
Yeah. How loud is it? Is it crazy? Is it good?
Well, we have worked. We're finally at a place that it's kind of under control. we've gotten quieter through the years, but they're always extremely loud, which made vocals super challenging to get on top of three different guitars on stage. And then, you know, we have a powerhouse drummer. That's always been a challenge. At this point, we're using baffles on stage and kind of baffling everybody into their positions so that there's not a ton of bleed from place to place. No one on that stage really is listening, has the same mix. I have three players that have different hearing issues, three that have pretty bad tinnitus. And so their needs are a lot different, and they're monitoring exactly what they need and trying to keep it as quiet as possible. It's a tricky little challenge to keep everybody in their spots happy.
What initially drew you to doing monitors?
What drew me to? I just got stuck there.
Then what kept you there?
By the time most people leave monitors to go to front of house, it was too late. Back in the late 80s, it was just Dave and I running the system. So everybody did what they needed to do. And he would do front of house, and I would be on stage. And I would wire stage and do monitors and everything by myself. So I never really...
Kind of calling them out. I like that.
Huh?
I said you're kind of calling them out. I like that.
Yeah, those front house guys.
Stay out there. Take care of your business.
Most people kind of, they'll learn to mix monitors, and as soon as they can, they go to front house. And I just didn't have that opportunity. That's what I ended up doing. So like if I were, I don't even leave stage. I don't like to go to front house. It's a completely different mindset. You need, absolutely, you know, on stage, we're all working together as a team. Front of house, you know, they've got to have big egos out there to deal with all that crap, you know?
Yeah. I really liked or resonated with, the connection you get with the artist, right? I mean, that satisfaction you get from knowing the direct impact you did or didn't have on that show, you know, whereas, you know, 10, 13, whatever, how many thousand people were out in the audience. I mean, you know, you can see this wave of emotion, but you're not directly connected with that symbiotic relationship.
Sure you are. The one drunk guy who's like, turn the cymbals up.
I can't even pay attention to those people because they'll distract me. I'll get focused on them. I'm like, and then next thing I'm getting yelled at for something. So audience does not exist. I love
what you said, Carrie, about like, you know, the band will notice when something changes. Cause one thing that we harp on in this show a lot, and we talk about mixing monitors, is it's not always about making the most perfect sounding mix you can. It's about consistency and giving that artist a consistent palette every night and how important that really is. And so I'm glad you said that. I'm really curious to learn more about, you know, when you have an artist with hearing loss, what are you doing to work around that, mitigate it? Obviously you can't completely compensate for it, but I mean, are you looking at their audiograms? How are you dealing with those issues?
Well, that's a tough thing. I think for us, it's everybody shares what they want with the crew or with me. You know, I'm not going to demand when we start up, I'm like, I want to see your hearing test. When was the last time you went to the audiologist? You know, so, you know, they're fairly open. Some of them are aware of their hearing loss and the range more so than other members. So I work with them to get them as comfortable as possible. You know, at the end of the day, it is a rock band, and there's really only so much that we can do. You know, you go back to the volume thing of, sure, it would be great to get rid of all the amps on stage and keep really low in-ear monitoring going. They're a rock band.
Yeah.
They want that energy that they get from their equipment, from the monitors, from the audience. You know, we've battled with, you know, just amp volumes, and it comes back to, can't do that because it changes the tone of the rig. Mm-hmm. It has to be at this volume because that's my sound.
Right.
So like if that is what you have to work with, then you have to work around that because it's, you know, we can sit there all day and go, please turn down. We all know what happens with that lasts for like 4 seconds.
Yeah. The tone is, you know, the tone's going to be
tone, what it is. Tone.
But, you know, I have a guitarist who, he had surgery on his middle ear. So when you get in there and you start messing with those bones, I mean, he has some significant losses in the mid range, which is where it really is the problem. Right. And, you know, it's so funny, like resisting the urge to tweak that mix, because when I cue it up, I'm like, it's really crazy. But no, it's perfect. It's exactly what he needs to hear what he needs to hear. So, you know, it's about not letting that drift over time back to what I think is more balanced.
Right.
I try to just make sure I'm checking in with them regularly. Like, hey, how are we doing? Even if they don't say anything, need anything? Are you comfortable? Do you want to hear, you know, and kind of sanding over those edges and letting, making them more comfortable asking for a change, you know?
Right. Right. Yeah.
I hate to make the correlation, but Pearl Jam has kind of turned into the Grateful Dead of this generation, just because they have such a catalog of crazy stuff that they can play. Do you mix with scenes, or do you do song to song, or
that set list is never the same?
Yeah, that's what I figured.
From night to it is different every single night. And they are not, you know, this is not a polished, choreographed, time-coded show. It's a rock show. And they're not, you know, they could start something and someone could not be in tune. And they'll just like, okay, we're going into this, or, oh, you know, sometimes they're out there, they're like, I forgot how to play this, you know, and they're like, what, how does this start? So They'll call a lot of audibles, and we just got to be prepared for that. We got to know what's coming down, or I could be setting something up because the set list says something and they're going to something else. So I'm like, okay, where are we going? I need to know that information right away. And this last rehearsals, unfortunately we never got to play a show, but there was a lot of different keyboards and synths going on this album. So I'm sitting in rehearsals and I'm talking to my tech. I'm like, I'm going to have to start building something, I'm like trying to figure out how I can do it manually and have that's all these cues ready to go. And he's like, don't go to scenes because it's just going to bite us in the ass at some point. So, no scenes.
Do you take notes or do you kind of got muscle memory?
I have a whole notebook full of notes. luckily not a lot of stuff changes. We add new things, but old songs are not getting rewritten or like we've decided we need something new. So a lot of that just becomes muscle memory. But yeah, I have notes and it's all on the set list every night. Hopefully I get it. that I can actually put my notes on it and cues.
It's funny. A buddy of mine was a guitar tech, and he did some Nine Inch Nails stuff for a while. And Reznor, this is back like in the BlackBerry days, and Reznor had given the whole crew BlackBerry specifically.
I love
it. So that like 10 minutes before the show, he could text all of them what the set list was. And then instantly, like him as a guitar tech had to go out there, program the pedal board and put it in the right order for the scenes. A monitor guy had to like do his thing. Like, so like no one knew on the crew what the set list was at night until like 10 minutes before the show. And that's simply what those BlackBerries were for.
Oh, and tell him what else the BlackBerry was for. The BlackBerry, after he texted the set list, he was like, somebody's going home tonight. Don't make it be you.
Yeah, that's how you always want to start a show.
Yeah, or a tour.
I kind of want to ask, just because it kind of came up on the Tech Theater Discord today, they were talking about it on there. What do you have in terms of a shout system or a squawk system during a show so that the techs can talk? And do you have something relatively more functional than a smaller tour would have?
It's by no means extravagant. We're at monitors, we have two SD5s. There's an SD5 for the band. And the gain structure and the EQ controls the second board. So Tommy is one of our techs. We have four people on the monitor crew. So he runs the other SD5 during the show and he's mixing for the techs. Because I attempted it when, at one point they were just, I was just giving them their guys, mix, giving them a redundant pack and that was fine. Then we dropped the techs to about a foot, just on wings, a foot off the ground. So they can't really hear what's going on stage anymore. So they ended up getting their own mixes. I attempted to do it for about 30 minutes and those guys drove me freaking crazy. Every 2 seconds, I need this. Can you put a compressor? I was just like, you need to go away. So the other SD5 functions as the tech mixes. If we have an opening band, the opening band's on that. And then it's backup.
So hold on. Do you know of any other artist out there that has a console for the backline techs?
I'm sure there are.
Holy cow.
I'm so glad I asked, because what an awesome...
I am sure there are. I mean, how many acts are out now that have two or three monitor engineers?
Yeah, but that's typically like the U2 thing, right? Or the Barry Manilow thing, or whatever, where it's like you have one for the main artist and then for the band. Yeah. Like that, I can see that concept. But for the freaking backline techs to have their own console...
And that many inputs and
outputs. We'll preface that with that it's my backup console. And... So if front of house goes down, that's the console. It's going to front of house, you know, or front of house is being routed through it. If my console goes down, we ran through it. It takes about 5 minutes for us to disconnect broken console and get that one up and running. And then for, you know, years ago, when we first went to digital, because everybody was like, oh, no, we can just put all the bands on this console. And I was like, sure. And then the first night I was like, I need to get into my office right now. And there's a support band on my desk.
Right.
And I'm like, this is not, I need, they have to be on a separate console. So, we had that console. And when I was like, I'm not mixing for the techs, we put them over there. And Tommy sits there with ears all night, and they all talk to each other. I can't listen to them because they talk all freaking night and just distract me. So if they need, you know, band guys will signal to me what they need. And we're pretty in tune, you know. A lot of times I know what they need before they even ask me. And then if they really need something, they'll tell their techs. Techs will tell Tommy, and Tommy will tell me. So
I'm curious. Something I experienced as a monitor engineer with the artists that you get really in tune with is that there are certain things that they do when they come out to sound check, and you can instantly gauge where their head is at and where the mood is at. And so when I was out with Tears or Fears, Roland, when he would come out, he would sing Kathy's song into his mic by himself, you know, Paul Simon, Kathy's song, I Hear the Drizzle of the Rain. And I could watch his body language as he sang that out, and he looks around, and I could, for like, it was a combination of like how long he sang it, how he felt, and then, you know, it was instant. I knew where he was at that day.
Right.
Do you have that moment or any of your artists where like, hey, there's something that kind of happens every day and I can kind of gauge, you know, where their headspace is at that day?
Yeah. If they're sound checking, usually just, I can tell by the mood when they walk in. And sometimes you're like, staying away from them today, you know, hopefully everything's, we're just going to get this done. A lot of times we don't sound check anymore. So, so that, you know, that is a whole different element, you know, you got the first three songs and then hopefully everybody settles in. Eddie will come in by himself, go through guitars, vocal, just kind of get a feel for the venue.
Let's jump back to the punk rock and
Fugazi.
More. Yeah.
Thank you, Chris.
What was
the Fugazi song? I love Blueprint. I love, dang, the three-song repeater album.
It's all good.
It changed my life. Are you kidding
me? They changed my life, too. I, you know, people are like, what tour would you want to do? And I was like, I already did it. And they're like, oh, Pearl Jam? I'm like, hell no, Fugazi. Yes. And, you know, and
I just want to let everybody know. Carrie is more punk rock than anybody who listens to this show, period. Way more punk rock than anyone who listens to the show or anyone who does the show.
Oh. Well, so for those who don't know what it would be like, and for the record, I have not experienced a Fugazi show.
I'm hoping that you might be able to experience one
sometime. What?
But
hey, I have no inside information. I just I'm keeping my fingers crossed that someday when the stars align that they might do some live shows.
Well, so describe, why was that the pinnacle for you? What was it like to experience a Fugazi show?
By hands down, best live band ever.
So good. So good. So
just, you know, I tried to, just so much power, so much energy. And for people that haven't listened to Fugazi, you know, it's, I don't even know how to classify. I mean, they stand on their own, you know, it's not there. You couldn't put them into, you know, oh, it's hardcore, you know, screaming right. punk rock, death metal, you know, they stand on their own. There's nothing, there's no other band like them.
No,
there's no other sound like them. And when they got on stage, they were just every night, just mind blowing.
I bet they had some great bands that they played with. Like, who did you find out? Because that was the cool thing when I was a kid. If you went to go see Fugazi, you almost went to go see who was opening
for
them.
I'm trying to think. Because when I was touring, you know, we would, you know, we didn't tour with bands. So it was local bands every day. And the shows were so weird. You know, there it was not a, I mean, I remember they did a tour on the West Coast, and this was it was probably 4 years after they hadn't been touring. They got back, you know, they weren't broken up, but they did a tour. I came out and did a bunch of shows with them. And we played the Palace in Los Angeles, which doesn't exist anymore. I don't even know. It's a dance club now, but we played there for like 3 nights and the tickets were $5 and parking was $7, you know? So, you know, the shows were, I mean, Ian booked all the shows himself. Like at the end of the night, he would write on a piece of paper, the address of where we were going. And I go, well, just trusted us to show up and made sure that we were going to load in and there was going to be a show. You know, we were on, you know, there was no tour manager, no tour bus. Got in the truck, drove until we were tired, got a hotel. Ian would buy the receipt the next day. We'd load in. Sometimes there would be crew. Sometimes it was a venue. Sometimes it was a YMCA gym, you know. So, like, all the bands were local bands. And honestly, I can't remember. And, you know, it's just a blur.
Kyle scribbling on a notepad over there. Like, he looked like he was ready.
What kind of, so you were torn at least with some gear, right? Or was it all local gear?
We did a tour that we took out a whole PA. So we were driving around truck, PA, monitors, backline. They had a sound guy. And one backline tech.
What console would he have been using at that time?
It was probably a Yamaha 2800. Yeah.
I think I would die to mix Fugazi one time.
It was the best. you know, there was no barricades. We'd start the show. The stage would move a foot back because people would run into it. And we're slammed up against the wall and sitting there mixing and holding the PA to make sure it wasn't going to fall over. You know,
it's Kyle's people.
Oh man, Fugazi changed my life more than Pearl Jam. I was a fan of Minor Threat, but holy cow, Fugazi, like.
It was powerhouse.
It was a powerhouse.
Powerhouse and the nicest people in the world.
What was the dynamic between, like, on one hand you had Black Flag, which is mm-hmm. the West Coast punk rock band of all times, and then mm-hmm. you had Fugazi, which was the DC band of, well, I don't know, you had Bad Brains, but like between
right.
those two. What was the biggest difference between those two bands for you?
Well, I came up and got into this because of Black Flag, because I was a fan. And I went to Black Flag shows and hung out at Black Flag shows, and that's how I met Dave Ratt. Didn't know anything about anything, and I met him, and said, I didn't even know what he did, but I was like, I want to learn what you do. And he's like, that is such a weird thing. But okay, this, you know, and he was just like, this is how you wind cables. I'm like, cool, what else? Like, let's go.
Nice.
So I met Black Flag and Dave towards the end of their last tour. So I didn't, never really worked with the band that much. I was the fan, and then I was the fan that got to hang out and load trucks at the end of shows. And then, you know, Fugazi was probably, I don't know, like what, 6-7 years later. So like the scene was definitely different by then. Yeah, and I remember the first time I saw them, you know, we were doing a show at the Palladium, and they were on tour, and we were the local sound company, and that show changed my life. Like, you know, as soon as I could, next day off, I was at the record store, every Fugazi album.
Wow. what was the, so what was the point when you, so you didn't know what you wanted to do, you discovered, you know, Dave and the sound thing via Black Flag. What was the point where you realized that, hey, this is definitely, I've made it, and this is where I'm going, I'm going to stay here? Right, there had been a point of like, I'm just kind of figuring this out, I'm surfing this, right? But where was that point of like, hey, I'm like, you know, I'm making this is what I'm gonna do.
As soon as Dave could pay me to work the whole show instead of just come and help him load out, and then I was able to quit my day job.
What was your day job?
Oh God, retail, and then I was working a horrible accounting job for a movie theater chain that I just sat in the office freaking putting receipts in the right places. Yeah, you know, and they're like, we're going to move you to junior accounting. And I'm like, oh my God, get me out of here. I can't do this.
So I'm curious, what was across your career and time working, what was one of the hardest problems you had to solve, and how did you solve it?
Oh, it's volume. Dealing with volume on stage and being able to get singers to hear at the level that they want to hear themselves. You know, I'm still like my guys are on ears, but they're still using wedges. My singer, he used ears for about 10 years, and then it was like, yeah, I'm done. I'm going back to wedges. So, you know, that's always a constant battle. I've done a ton of one-offs with bands that were quiet, and they were a pleasure to mix, and everything was easy. But most of my career I've been spent mixing super loud bands on stage.
Speaking of vocals and vocalists, Chris
Michael.
Cornell.
I'm kidding.
Chris Cornell. That's, you know, that's what comes to mind.
And Soundgarden.
Oh, man. Yeah. Chris, yes.
Like
Chris Cornell.
That was probably like listening to an angel every night. That's what I imagine. Even in the early days of Soundgarden, when it was the raw Seattle.
Oh, God, it was so raw. No, I mean, like raw in a great way. I mean, that was another band that was just like, you never knew it was going to happen. There was so much energy, and you know, it was insane. Chris was amazing.
Insane. I got to meet him one time at an award show, and he came over and smoked a cigarette with me and just hung out like a normal dude. And
right.
It was one of the coolest, like, I'll tell that story till I die. Like, yeah. What a cool guy.
Yeah. Yeah. All those guys, all Soundgarden guys are great. just, you know, all everybody in the Seattle scene is just down to earth, you know.
I believe it. I believe that probably Kim Thayil, his volume was probably one of the more insane ones.
Kim and Ben both extremely loud, and as loud as Matt plays in Pearl Jam, he played even louder in Soundgarden. But the difference was that there was only one guitar and one bass, and there wasn't all this, you know, it was loud, but there wasn't three guitars on stage competing with each other. A lot of times, you know, if we were in smaller places or stuff, you just walk on stage and it was just noise for Pearl Jam, you know? So neither one of them was super, neither band was super easy to mix, but Soundgarden, you just had a little more space for things, you know? But Chris could never hear. I mean, Chris is a, you know, and I mean, even with ears, I mean, the last time I worked with him, I wasn't mixing for Chris, but it was Temple of the Dog tour. Josh, he works for Pearl Jam, in many capacities. He's a multi-talented tech, but he was mixing Chris's ears on that tour because Chris, he just was mixed like the album. But even with ears, you know, it was still a struggle to get him at the volume that he wanted and needed to be.
So, you know, most people, you know, listening to this probably already know about Sound Girl. So we don't need to rehash the how Sound Girls got started thing, right? But I'm curious, you guys have a new big project going on. What can you talk about what that project is and what you guys are trying to accomplish?
It's called the Sound Girls Living History Project. We have about five, maybe six interviews that are up on our YouTube page. So everybody go there and check them out.
We'll put a link down in the description as well to make it easy.
Yeah, right. The idea was to have, you know, pretty organic, long, in-depth interviews with veterans in the industry. Obviously, for now, they're all women, but we're not excluding men, but, you know, Sound Girls first and foremost focuses on women because they're overlooked in the industry. And so there are interviews with veterans, you know, that have been, that were either groundbreakers or, you know, pretty much we're letting our members interview people so that I'm not doing them, Michelle's not doing them, that they're bringing these people to us. They're usually, the few that have been done are, you know, they're heroes of whoever's interviewing. Mm-hmm. And so that adds a really great aspect because they have, for the most part, have thoroughly researched these people and they're coming at it, I guess, as a fan.
Right. And
so they're asking, you know, they're asking different questions that, you know, a professional interviewer would, you know, they're not polished. So they're super in depth. And the idea is so that, you know, we could go a little bit further with the interviews, also preserve them and have them in the history books because there's just not a lot of women that are documented. And then have the interviews available for anybody that's doing research.
Yeah.
That they can use, you know, get the transcripts, go through it, use the audio, use it for books, research.
That's great.
So yeah, they've been fun and, yeah, everybody should go check it out.
I love the concept of having your network. I mean, the Sound Girls network has just exploded in the last couple of years, and that whole divide and conquer mentality is amazing. You know, I mean, that what you can accomplish with that is huge. And, you know, there is definitely a difference in someone who cares about who they're talking to and what you'll be able to pull out of them, as opposed to just like, oh, here's my list of questions. Let's get through the, you know, oh, how'd you get your start? You know, like, there's more to it than just that. And I can't wait to check out some of them. It's good stuff. I haven't watched them. Are they like just raw video, or are they edited up to make it like polished?
The only edits we've done to them is like if someone's doorbell rang and they had to go. they've been done on Zoom.
That's great.
And they're just, you know, we're not dividing them up into one part. I think we did one that's a part one and part two, but I think for the most part, we're just going to, they're coming in around 2 hours and just leave them like that.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, you've put together, along with your team, an amazing group of people. I love the Facebook group. I love that I even got accepted. I love that I can answer questions and listen.
Yeah, we'd love to have you there.
and I love watching the people that aren't. I think that's the cool thing about Sound Girls, is like they ask the hard questions that some people just don't even ask. And there's always someone on the Facebook page or in the network that will immediately, not one answer, but five different ways to get an answer. And it is one of the coolest things. And I think, shout out to you and the team, because you guys did great.
Yeah.
Amazing.
I think we're pretty proud of that Facebook group. I'm not going to say it's always completely polite and nice.
Look, it's still social media, right? There's always going to be a level of
social media. But for the most part, if someone posts a question, they're going to get, you know, like Kyle said, four or five answers right away. And no one's going to make them feel stupid.
No. And they're like honest and heartfelt. And like, I think a lot of the questions that we need to ask as mixers and engineers and people around this business are heartfelt, because it's the only way that you're going to get a really good answer, or at least multiple ways to go about getting your solution, you know? And I think Sound Girls broke it open, man. Like, if you do some of that stuff on Turd Guy audio page, like it would spiral into social media demise. You'd get a bunch of gifts, like just bad stuff, and I think it's super awesome.
I had a guy a couple of years ago, he probably messaged me on Facebook or something, but he was a musician, and he had posted something in some audio group for an actual real question that he needed an answer, and they just slammed him. And then made fun of him that he was a musician. And I was like, we work for musicians. What is wrong with you people?
That is the cardinal sin, is to stomp out that interest in someone who had the courage to ask a question. That's a hard thing to do, man. It really is. And the worst thing you can do is make that person feel stupid. That drives me nuts. I want to kind of expand on that. We've had some people, we have our own little mentorship program that we put together through our group here, which Kyle started actually.
I picked up another one today, by the way.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
That's great. And when people reach out, I mean, a lot of the emails say like, you know, hey, it was really, you know, I really had to talk myself into reaching out to you. And that's kind of a little speed bump for people to kind of commit to do it. You've worked with so many young people getting them into the field. I mean, what are some things that maybe some advice you would give to somebody who's struggling with that, you know, being assertive enough to say, hey, I'm interested in this. Can you show me something?
Yeah. The best advice at first is find someplace that's safe. You know, even as a veteran, I mean, like I have a group of engineers that I trust on my phone, on speed dial, if I get into like, what the fuck is going on today, that I can call. And I know they're going to go, what's going on? Okay, go open this up. They're not going to go, you're an idiot. Why are you calling me? You know, like, I can't, you know, they're safe. they're not going to laugh at me. And we all hit places that you're just like, oh, I can't believe I did that. Right. So find a place that's safe and nurturing and that people aren't going to do that to you. And don't be afraid to ask. I mean, like, if you go through half of our blogs or our profiles, everybody's like, make sure you ask questions. There are no stupid questions. We, you know, it's better to ask questions than to do it wrong. Yeah. And, you know, so, but, you know, that is also super hard. You know, if you're a new crew person starting out and it's the first time you've worked with these people and you're not quite sure what you're supposed to be doing or how they want you to do it, it's hard to make that leap of like, how do you want me to do this? So, you know, a lot of people are just out, you know, want to prove themselves, and they might not know what, how to do what you've just asked them to do, but they won't ask you and they'll go ahead and do it anyway. And then you're just like, where did you go? And this was the cable I asked him, what's going on? You know, like, or they're run and nothing's plugged in, or they've run and you're just like, where's this going?
or the 200-foot cable that's run backwards. That's the best one.
Exactly.
We were talking about this the three of us have a group text. And, you know, one of the things I said the other day was like, I think more people like to know stuff than people who like to learn stuff. Like, everybody loves to know stuff, but yeah, a lot of people don't want to learn. And it's like, I don't like this kind of, you know, I've been doing this for 30 years or insert number here. I mean, that doesn't mean there's not a better way to do it. That doesn't mean someone hasn't come up with a new thing. I mean, as soon as I'm done learning, I'm done. I don't want to, you know what I mean? That's it for me. I love learning stuff.
I can't stand people that go, I've been doing this for 30 years. That doesn't mean, you know, I can tell my band, I've been mixing you for 30 years. And they're like, yeah, but fucking everything's out of phase and it sucks and we're firing you. Like, you know, so like, there's always stuff to learn. And there's way more things to learn than any of us have time for. You know, so I always focus on, you know, I kind of keep my feelers out of new technology and what's going on. But at the end of the day, I'm like, what do I need to know for my job? What tools do I have to have?
So what are you pursuing right now? If you're in the pursuit of continuing knowledge, what are you pursuing right now?
You know, that's a good question. I was just thinking about that today, and I just wrote a blog about like preparing to go back to work. Maybe, I don't know, maybe fall-ish, maybe if we're lucky. But you know, I was thinking about, I'm like, where's my gig bag? Where's my passport? And where are my show files? I mean, and my ears. I think my ears are locked in my workbox.
That's what I found.
I hope they are. And yeah, see, I was leaving on tour 3 days after rehearsal. So all my stuff got put in my workbox because I was going to see it in 3 days. I will probably do some brush up soon on like Shure wireless workbench and make sure all of that is ready to go when I go back out.
Do you do RF coordination with the stadiums before you get there, or do you kind of take a hold of yourself?
I've been doing most of the RF once in a while. Like right now I have, my tech is more than capable of doing it, but I still get like, if it's going to fail, it should be on me. I don't want to walk in the dressing room and at the end of a show and have to put it on, go, I don't know. If it's going to fail, it's going to be me. So I still do most of the RF coordination. We're kind of in the middle. We have a lot of RF, but we're not Beyonce. So,
Neither are we, Carrie. Neither are we. No one is.
And then, you know, if we're playing a festival, most festivals now have RF coordination, or if we're doing, Global Citizen or something, and then I send them all our information, and hopefully they have it all routed and ready to go when we get there.
So I got an important question. Hot dogs, are they sandwiches or tacos?
Hot dogs, they're
I don't know if I like those are the two available choices.
I don't know.
Well, think about it.
I understand what you're asking. I disagree with I think you're making a little black or white there, Chris. I think hot dogs.
I'm going to lean more to a sandwich because I think a hot dog and a taco, that's a disgrace to tacos. Thank you.
No, I was loading in a show on Monday or whatever. It was at like a pharmaceutical headquarters, and they had like this whiteboard of like just people like would write things down the hallway for things, and literally it was the question on the whiteboard, and I was like, I'm going to ask that next episode. I don't care who we're talking to. I'm asking that question.
That was me.
Chris, I think it is time for your big 2021 question though. So why don't you fire that thing off, man?
Sure, and I have a feeling I know the answer, but I'm gonna ask it anyway.
I got another fanboy question.
Go, do your fanboy one first.
Okay, since we didn't touch on it, Red Hot Chili Peppers. Mm-hmm. Man, I really liked Freaky Style and Mother's Milk. Why don't they play any of those songs really anymore?
I don't know.
They're so good. I showed my 7-year-old daughter Mother's Milk, and she loves it. My lady hates me for playing it all the time, but what a great album. Holy cow.
It was a great album. I don't know. It was funny. Last year, I hadn't seen those guys for a long time. And then Eddie puts on a festival called Ohana Fest every year down in Dana Point in California. And Chili Peppers were playing. So I think that was the first time I saw them, probably for like 6 years.
Wow.
And then I couldn't really, I was on stage and I watched their show because Ed was going to play with them. But I couldn't, they're all on ears and I couldn't hear vocals. And I'm like, what song are they playing? And then it was funny because Flea does his benefit for his music conservatory, and Ed ended up playing that like 3 weeks later. So it was like all of a sudden, like Chad was like, it's 1991 again.
Yeah. Bring it back.
Yeah, we're back. I don't know. Maybe they will now that Frusciante's back in the band.
Yes. All right. Fanboy question's over. Dang it. I have so many more.
You got a couple good ones in there though, Kyle. You did good. Man. You did good.
So Carrie, if you could define your legacy, what would it be?
My legacy.
Bum bum bum.
I don't know. That's a hard question.
I mean, you're asking.
I've never put myself in a legacy.
You've established a huge one already, though. I mean, it's kind of low hanging fruit with her because she has made such a huge impact on the field already, man. Talk about her like she's not here. She's right here. She can hear me.
Well, no, I know that. And like, I guess the other way to put this is like, so if you were to be known for one thing, what would you want to be known for?
I don't know. That's tough.
I
raised two daughters that were way smarter than me and their dad.
Mom. Best job in the world is being a parent.
Well, first off, I love the fact that your first instinct goes to your kids. I mean, to me, like, I thought the low-hanging fruit was going to be what you have done to impact this industry for women. I mean, that is, to me, like, if I were to define Carrie, that's you changed the landscape of this industry for women. There's no ways around that.
Well, I appreciate that and definitely humbled by it. I'm very honored to be able to support women and be their voice if they don't have a voice in the industry. And I guess, yeah, I guess that's my legacy, is that I didn't screw up enough in this industry so people listened to me. And, you know, when Michelle and I decided to start it, we were just kind of over it. We were simply over anybody going, I've never seen a woman do this. And we're like, oh, Christ's sake, come on. Been doing this for 25 years. Don't you just say,
oh, bless your heart. Now you have.
Do you feel a shift in the momentum? I mean, even in the last couple of years, I think it's the visibility that you've been able to achieve, and a couple other, you know, groups, and just the industry as a whole. I mean, I really do feel like, I mean, it's a tugboat, right? But I do feel that it's starting to become more visible.
Yeah. You know, I think from starting it 8 years ago, 7 years ago, I think it's 8 years now. You know, it was kind of like, it went from, okay, we're talking about the lack of diversity, to, okay, what are we going to do about it? To, we want to diversify our crew. How do we do it? How do we find these people? So we're, in that respect, we're making progress. And that's huge. You know, it's huge that the people in hiring positions are aware that this is an issue now.
Yeah. We were talking about that with Bill Reeves when he had him on the show too. And it's a similar idea. You know, it's not an overnight, let's just go out and hire more women or whatever. I mean, like, you have to look at, well, who's going into schools and studying this stuff, and how do you build interest when people are young? So, I mean, that it takes some time for that to kind of filter through, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So, but I mean, I just, you know, in terms of the industry consciousness, I can just say from, you know, I read the trade mags and stuff like that, it does seem like we're taking some small but positive steps in that regard.
Yeah.
So this might be a question you don't have an answer for, and that's fine.
the way you said it, it sounded like it wasn't fine, Chris.
I'll handle him after the show, Carrie.
No, I heard this question asked on some other podcast somewhere, and so for someone like yourself who has been, you've been interviewed by tons of people, you have your own community, you get asked questions all the time. What's maybe a question that no one asks you that you maybe wish that they would ask you?
Damn.
Yeah, that's I don't know. You guys have done pretty good of not asking the same old questions. So that's great.
That was the goal. Chris texted me and asked 50 times. So that's cool. We did it. Pulled it off.
I think people tend to not ask what the real skills you need are. You know, a lot of times they focus on, the SD5, or what ears are you using, and why do you like them, and why do you use an OM7? But knowing what tools you need for the job is huge, right?
Yeah.
You know, not getting caught up in whatever new black boxes come out and having to have it, right?
Yeah. You know? Yeah, like understanding, like, just because I saw this act that I like and she uses this mic, that doesn't mean I should put all my artists on this mic. Yeah. Like, you know, knowing, I mean, this is a conversation I had with Kyle. I called him and I said, here's what I'm dealing with. This is my vocalist. She does this, this, and this. Here's the problems I'm having. And he said, okay, based on all that, here's a mic I think you should try. So it's like knowing when the tool is right for the job, I think.
Yeah. Like, you know, you see those questions of like, what's the best mic for female vocalists?
Right.
What does that even mean? Like
bad marketing almost.
You know, so you need to be able to pick through those things and critically think about them, and if they're going to benefit you if you're using them, or if they're going to bring you more headaches, right? That you could something could be the greatest sounding whatever, and if it crashes every 40 seconds, it's useless, right? And still, at the end of the day, the most important skill is your personality.
For sure. Thank you.
You know?
Yeah, baby.
Yep. Being able to spend the rest of your day away from that show, getting along and doing your gig?
You know, that's, I was so in the service industry.
So you've accomplished so much in your career, both from a audio engineer standpoint to a social awareness and stuff like that. What is Carrie looking forward to? What do you have left to accomplish? What are you shooting for beyond now?
Well, I am looking towards when the band is done. You know, I don't think Pearl Jam's going to be the Rolling Stones at 75, however old they are. I don't know how old they are.
I think they're 306.
306, something combined, right? I don't know. They're not going to launch at 65. They're not going to launch an 18-month world tour. I mean, we don't do that now. So it's going to get, I'm not going to say that they're going to retire and say farewell, but I see them more of like, you know, we're a summer band and we play these stadiums during the summer. So I'm kind of looking, and you know, I'm not going to fool myself. I'm not going to get hired with Billie Eilish because I'm too old to be on that tour. Right. I don't really want to be hanging out with kids on the tour bus. So, nothing against kids, but, so I'm kind of looking at how I'm going to exit the industry.
Well, so hold on. What's sit there for a second. I don't care how long we've already recording here. So Kyle often brings that up, like, hey, what we need to talk about, what the exit game looks like.
Yeah, what's the game, man?
So what have you thought about that, or are you just starting to the cusp of thinking about that?
No, I've thought about it for a while. And I think COVID probably brought it into people's lives in a very real way. You know, I think everybody in the industry, you know, if they don't know this, but they should, that they need 3 to 6 months safety net for when there's not a lot of work or something like 9/11 happens and shows cancel. And the COVID has obviously shown us that 6 months, 3 to 6 months is nothing. I'm not happy, but about having to dip into retirement funds that there wasn't a ton of, but there was set aside. But, you know, I didn't end up losing my house, and I'm not working at Amazon. So happy about that. Will I be able to retire? No. Was I going to be able to retire before? Not really. I think we need to, you know, the industry needs to start having long-term discussions about how to prepare for retirement. How long you're going to do this, what happens when you hurt your back and you can't move your anymore, what happens when you lose your hearing. I think it's super important.
I think it's difficult for, you know, as I think about like, what could you do to your community or tell your community about this, you know, or what could we tell our community about this? And as much as Kyle wants to talk about it, as much as you want to talk about it, you know, it's that age old thing of like, you're 20 something, whatever. You don't want to hear this shit. Right. Yeah. So, but at least if we try, all we can do is say, hey, here's what I've experienced. Here's where my head is at. I mean, if you yourself are saying, hey, you spent the last 40 years or whatever your career, and even pre-COVID, you weren't even sure you'd actually be able to retire. Right. And there's people who are lucky if they've done 10 years of touring, right? That I hope that people soak that in for a minute and realize, like, hey, like this, like I'm not trying to discourage anyone from this business.
No. Yeah, no, but it's real.
Yeah.
It's real. And like, you know, if you're starting in this industry, your 20s and early 30s are the best time to start putting this stuff into place, because probably you're not, you don't have a partner, or you're not married and you don't have kids, and you probably didn't buy a house, you know, so that those are all things that, you know, I was a single mom, had a mortgage, two kids, put them through, you know, they went to private schools. Yes, touring allowed them to do that, but also, you know, I could have put that money into my retirement too. So, you know, those first 15 years of touring, if you can stay on tour, if it's what you want to do, if you can stay on tour all year, and then maybe just couch surf, or now you can Airbnb for the 2 weeks in between things, right? Not have rent, not have a mortgage, and save all that money, it'd be golden.
I get an interesting question that I'm curious on your insight on. So many people in this industry, their partners, husbands, wives, whatever, relationships are destroyed because of this industry. And often people are put at a crossroads of having to choose this industry over their family or life. This is a hard thing to process, but is there ever a right time to abandon your family for this industry? Or do you think ultimately people will think, hey, that was a foolish decision? Because I know people in both camps. I know people who have chosen, hey, this industry is where I'm going regardless. Other people say, nope, I'm leaving because of my family. And I'm not here to judge anyone. Everyone has their own path. But what do you maybe have any advice or perspective in that moment of where to even put your head?
Yeah, I mean, you got to do some deep soul searching when you hit that crossroads, right? After I had my daughters, you know, I was like, I guess I'm going back to school, become a teacher or something. Can't tour anymore. I can't do shows. Because it just felt so like, wait, you're going to hire a nanny for 24 hours so you can go work a show? Like, we don't have 8 to 5 hours. When you're working even a show locally, you're there for 16 hours, right? And then you got to come home and sleep. You know, I did that a couple times, and I was just like, you know, the kids are up, and you're just like, I just went to bed. But, you know, I came to the realization that's being on the road, not, you know, being on the road makes me happy. That's what I do. And, you know, I had a woman that she was a tour manager. She was the only other woman that I knew that had a kid and toured. And she was like, you got to do what makes you happy, because it's going to make you a better parent. You know, you could stay home and be there for your kids all the time and have a 9-to-5 job. And if you're miserable, you're going to be a miserable parent. So that's what worked for me. At the same time, you know, I wasn't touring all the time. I still, one of the main reasons I'm with Pearl Jam is because we don't tour. We don't do an 18-month tour. We do 6 weeks, and then we have a month off, and then 5 weeks and a month off, you know? So you kind of, you know, find things that balance and work for your family. Some families work really well, and, you know, I know spouses that they don't want their spouse off the road. They're like, when are you going back?
People have realized that more than ever now. All right, let's bring this back up for a minute before we end this out, right? Yeah. So what is your favorite place to eat anywhere in the world?
Oh, my God. Anywhere in Japan.
Yes. Yes.
Pretty much.
Tell me about it. I'll close my eyes.
Yeah.
Dude, insane. There's a place called Freshness Burger, and I actually have dreams about that place. And of course, all the sushi places, that place that Bourdain went to in the train station where the old dude handed you the pieces.
There's just great food everywhere. Yeah. Anywhere in Japan.
Carrie, we greatly appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
So cool. Yeah, it's been awesome having you on the show, and definitely want to thank you for sharing your expertise and your knowledge. And we're going to put some links in the description to the Oral History Project. We encourage everybody to check that out. I just subscribed to it on YouTube myself, so I'm looking forward to seeing more of those as they come out. So
check out the Sound Girls Facebook group, and that's good stuff there.